Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talkart.
Welcome to Talkart.
How are you feeling, Rob?
I'm feeling really grateful.
Oh?
For artists. Because art has changed my life.
Same.
And the artist that we're going to meet today, I am really grateful for. Because I think her work is so incredible mm-hmm. and so important. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, it's been overlooked for a ridiculously long time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that our artist today, who we're meeting, is getting to see that people love and respect what she has done
yes.
for many decades.
I'm also thankful for that.
Because I think her work is so powerful and intelligent, and it's almost like a weapon for change. And that really is what art should do. It should change the world. And even if it's in a small way or a large way, but somehow make the world better for other people.
Change the dialogue.
And I have so much respect, and I'm actually nervous myself because I've done so much research, and I'm such a fanboy, basically, of our artist. So we would like to welcome Caroline Kuhn. Hello, Caroline.
Hello, welcome.
We welcome you. We're welcoming you.
And I'm welcoming everybody into the conversation.
Fantastic. Love that.
That's what we want. How are you doing today?
I'm all right.
Yeah.
Feeling very nervous, but also very lucky. Mm-hmm. And let's consider this to be a little bit of an experiment, because, as you said, my work has been not considered for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I haven't had the privilege, really, to speak about my work in public. But I also like to say that it's been rather an advantage. I've done what some people have told me is very controversial. I was told that my work was too political, mm-hmm. too socially conscious. Mm-hmm. And therefore I've been able to paint for almost 50 years in private mm-hmm. without the pressure to produce the amount of work that, say, a gallery would want you to produce. Mm-hmm. I've been able to do exactly what I wanted without any market-type pressure. Mm-hmm. And so I'm only thankful that I've reached this old age, 74, and suddenly people are looking at work that I have conscientiously and with great care created over all these years, because I might have been dead. I feel extremely lucky that suddenly people are looking at and liking, or not that you don't, I don't need to be liked so much, but I'd like to stimulate conversation.
People are responding to your work in such, literally within the last 6 months, it feels like the dialogue has changed and there is a huge focus on you. And you've arrived today with a catalogue that's been printed called Caroline Kuhn, the Great Offender, from Tramps Gallery, is the show still up now or is it just closed?
The show is on until the end of December.
The end of December, which
I think it closes on the 22nd.
Everybody has to go and see. I saw it the other day, and I tell you why I saw it, because has been such an influx of support on Instagram, and especially from people like Louisa Buck, who is an amazing critic, friend of Talkart, friend of mine and Rob's, and she has been such a champion of you and saying, wake up Tate, why are we not collecting? Why is this work not for everyone? Why is this not being kept in as for like integrity forever? And I went to see the show and it absolutely blew my mind. I think you are the most incredible painter, and it is following a frustrating pattern where so many female artists are being overlooked, ignored, and then they do get to a later stage in life and everyone goes, oh wow, this work's amazing, why haven't we been paying attention to this? And it's so annoying. And you look at people like, but it's incredible now that you're able to experience it, but you look at people like Rose Wiley or Carmen Herrera. I don't know why that happens, why there is this talent here that's being created, but it just gets...
Can I tell you one of the reasons why?
Yes.
My work, I think, caused a controversy and was overlooked. But before I just say, I'm very lucky because Martin Green and James Lawler came to me 18 months ago and gave me the exhibition in Liverpool, which alerted Peter Doig and Parnes Mogadasi of tramps to my work to bring the Great Offender show to London. But, okay, the reason why I think my work was overlooked is because when I was a teenager, I noticed that a lot of the naked women in art were called prostitutes. That you couldn't, in a sense, you wouldn't see a naked woman in art without the art historian or the critique saying this is a prostitute, and that also made me wonder where if I am a woman and I'm looking in an art gallery, where are naked men? And so I thought, well, I would redress the balance, and I would put as many naked men in my paintings as possible. And that led me to the realization that the male nude, unless it's Christ on the cross, which is in fact the most pervasive male nude in culture, caused a huge controversy amongst the heterosexual male. Because the thing is, if you have a beautiful male Adonis nude in a gallery, and a man who's identified himself as a patriarchal heterosexual male, thinks it's a beautiful painting and is attracted by the male nakedness, he then worries that he is going to be called homosexual.
Right.
And so that my male nudes fed into the hysteria about gay culture. And if you remember, when I was a teenager, it had only just been made legal for consenting adults to have
homosexual
male in private.
Yeah, 50 years. It's only been 50 years ago, wasn't it?
Yes,
50 years since it's been made legal.
And I said, well, if you're going to, I always said to anybody who came and was interested in my work, I'm not going to have you ban my naked male. And so it was considered very controversial. And then that fed into the feminist movement, who, for feminists, for a certain narrative in feminism, the cock, the penis, was the icon of let me try this again. My headphones have fallen off. All this excitement about penises.
Yes. Mine are falling off as well. Mine are rocks about slipping down. Keep going. Keep talking about it, please.
The penis was was the emoji or the icon of patriarchy. And so a woman who was painting the penis was considered to be anti-feminist.
Wow. And you were called that, the woman who paints penises, weren't you, for a while?
Yes, because my naked men were causing such a controversy.
Right.
And my feeling was that, if as a woman to procreate, which is one of the most beautiful things that you can do and is emblematic of life.
Evolution,
I'm going to draw a penis into my body. Mm-hmm. And therefore, to me, the penis is the most beautiful thing that you could possibly paint.
Mm. Amen. Amen to that. And what did that feel like to be controversial at the time, for people to say you were controversial because you were painting dicks?
It felt that it was something that I had to negotiate.
With yourself or with?
With myself. With my own ego and my own self-confidence as an artist, but then also outside my studio, in the wider world. It was, how am I going to live if everything that I stand for as a person is going to cause controversy, and I'm going to be censored. In the wider world, you know, how will I manage to keep on painting?
How do you navigate that?
Yeah. Yes, and so you know, there's that struggle between your internal dialogue.
Yeah,
and then how
what the story you want to tell? Should I? Yeah. Yes, that is a struggle, because if you put that out there, is that going to restrict you in certain ways? But again, that is what your artistic voice in your head is telling you to create. So I guess you have that battle.
And I think also, I think Alice Walker said something great, is that activism is the rent I pay for living on Earth. Something like that.
Wow.
And from a very early age, I come from, perhaps you can tell from my accent, I come from an upper-class family. Uh-huh. Just to be a girl was controversial. The whole of the class that I was born into catered to the patriarchy. I'd seen my grandmother, who wasn't allowed to be a musician. I'd seen my mother, who wasn't allowed to be an artist. And their misery at not being able to do what they wanted to do was kind of...
And was that quite palpable as a child? You could
feel
that?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, why are my grandmother and my mother so angry?
Yeah.
So, and there was a kind of sadism in that anger, which is visited on children.
Wow.
And, you know, as a girl child, I wasn't allowed... You know, it's a very hunting, shooting, fishing kind of environment.
Right.
Because you grew up in Kent, didn't you?
Yes. Landed.
Yeah. Gentry.
Not exactly. I mean, they aspired to be, yes, they aspired, you know, they aspired to be the ruling class.
Right.
And the higher up the class hierarchy you go, the more conservative you have to be.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I could only kind of be myself by running away from home, because... as a girl, the only thing that I was going to be allowed to do was to get married and to be a breeder.
To be a wife and a mother.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And have boy children.
Mm. Right.
You know, so it was only until quite recently, well, actually in the 80s, when people would say to me, how many children do your parents have? And I'd say five, more my brothers. And I'd forget that actually I was one of my parents' children, because I was the girl, the oldest girl.
Wow.
Well, so they had six children, but you would say five?
Yes.
Yeah, wow.
And I think we, we forget how embedded in our culture these tropes of oppression are. And so anyway, for me to be controversial was just a way to save my life.
Wow.
I really loved this story as well, that because of that almost pain that you saw your mother and your grandmother in, because their creativity had kind of been stifled and silenced, that you felt this urgent need to sort of go to London to find your family in other people, in friends and artists and creative musicians, and that you went to St. Martin's, I think, is that
in the
correct?
60s, you went to St. Martin's Art School.
I went to Central.
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 Right.
Central, yeah. But even there, you suddenly realised, hang on a minute, I'm in another type of patriarchy, or even the music industry that you became part of as well. Like you kept trying to find like a place for yourself, and constantly found all these different types of patriarchies that were trying to suppress you and silence you in a way.
Well, I think isn't that the same for the three isms that we had to fight from after the Second World War, racism. Mm-hmm. Homophobia, sexism, and although I think youth today is having to struggle with different sets of oppressions, my God, in the last 50 years, as a result of gay liberation, the Black Power movement, feminism, we have come a huge long way.
Mm. Yeah.
But, you know, so that's, to a certain extent, I'm now learning to talk a little bit about my childhood, because until we know from where we've come, we can't really adequately challenge where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So when did you start transferring energy into paint to make him work?
When I grew, I was very lucky because I went to a ballet school,
mm-hmm.
And that is a kind of like a holistic creative environment. Mm-hmm. You know, you learn to dance, you learn to play music.
You look like you have like a balletic posture as well.
You do have a very good posture.
You have like...
get a five-year-old and teach her how to plie, and she can plie for the rest of her life.
You know? If only this had video, we'd get you to do that right now.
You know, I'll do the dance of the little swans if you like.
Yes,
I
please.
Mean, I still remember. So right from the early, from very early age, mm-hmm. I knew I was going to be an artist. But it was then how to get to art school, really.
Were you exposed to art at an early age through your family?
Yes.
Did you go to galleries or did you have art in the family? Or
art very much in the family. I had, what is my grandfather's brother? Is that a great uncle?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was kind of a black sheep of the family because he was an artist too. He was a Royal Academician.
Really?
And he was a black sheep because he was an RA.
And he would know he was an artist.
Right.
And the higher up the hierarchy you go, you know, to be an artist is kind of to
acceptable.
Be an outsider. Not acceptable.
Right.
Outsider. But he was, his name is F.M. Bennett. He was a Royal Academician and he did what my parents would call chocolate, you know, if you, in the 50s, if you were buying a chocolate box with a kind of a Victorian scene on it, it could be by F.M. Bennett.
Right.
And so, and his, it was, I'll tell you a funny story. So he, you know, the house were full of my great uncle's paintings.
Right.
And he got a Prix de Rome, I think.
What's that?
From the slit, I think that you were, if you were an excellent painter, you got a prize which sent you to Rome to paint.
Right.
Oh.
And so he was painting very Victorian. And back in the day, you would have to copy masterpieces.
Right.
And so the house was kind of, had my great uncle's fantastic portraits of masterpieces from another age, which my parents could then pass off as if it was ancestral paintings.
Right. Heirlooms. I mean, right.
You know, yes, it was. So the house was full of paintings.
And a lot of figuration you saw there.
A lot of figuration, a lot of great drawing.
Mm.
There was the myth that there was a drawing of my grandfather's father who was meant to be a mayor of Bristol who was then drawn by John Singer Sargent.
Wow. Oh my.
Wow. But they didn't have the John Singer Sargent.
They had the replica
that your uncle.
Real little sketch.
Wow.
But when you're a child you kind of believe these family myths. And you know, and I'm thinking maybe it is a myth, but it was a very beautiful drawing in the style of. And so my admiration for the craft of art, for drawing, was really innate in me, I think, from a
And you liked the work that was around you?
Yes.
Wow.
Something I heard you talk about before was this idea that even when you were at Central St. Martin's, that you were never really told that being an artist and being a woman artist was even a possibility, because there weren't really that many examples for you to look at, because all the art you'd seen was mainly done by men. And the artists that you did see who were women artists often got left out of shows, including Pauline Boty, and how remarkable she was as an artist and as someone who inspired you in your life.
Yeah.
Yes, I really have been very lucky because, I went to do pre-dip at a provincial art college.
What's pre-dip? Sorry.
Pre-dip is what you do before you have to get your pre-dip before you get your art. You go to the 3-year.
Ah, like a foundation course.
Yes, you'd call it foundation course.
Okay.
So I went to did my foundation course in a provincial art school where they were still teaching drawing. Then I came to Central, and it's true there were no women tutors. Women, I think the example that you can give that all the textbooks that you were reading about art, say Gombrich's The History of Art, no women in it.
Uh-huh.
And then my tutor Derek Boucher, who was one of the founders of the pop art movement, recognised, I think he liked the political content of my work, because there was a very lot of working class artists in the pop art movement, and discussing their ideas were political. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'd like to introduce you to my colleague Pauline Boaty. Mm-hmm. And that Pauline Boaty's work blew my mind. Then pop art blew my mind, mm-hmm. in the sense of how you can make your work political. Pauline Boaty was doing fantastic paintings called It's a Man's World One, It's a Man's World Two. She was doing pictures of civil rights in America. Mm-hmm. She was doing pictures about Cuba. Mm-hmm. If you remember, David Hockney was out very bravely at that time, doing doing work about his love of
male nudes.
Male nude. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so I was introduced to Pauline Boaty. And when she died, just, I think, 6 months later, her husband gave me Pauline Boaty's paints.
Wow. What a gift.
I think Clive Goodwin, founder of a very political magazine called Black Dwarf. Oh. Anyway, the fact that he gave me Pauline's paints gave me this kind of sense that I'm going to carry the torch for this wonderful political artist.
Yes.
Oh, amazing.
And whenever in my life I felt suicidal or very down and depressed because I'm broke, yes. and nobody's looking at my art, I would think, well, you know, carry on.
I wasn't aware of Pauline's work before researching you, to be honest. And actually now I think it's revolutionary. And there's a work of yours which really stood out, which was Cunt, is the title of the piece, which is like a proscenium arch, very theatrical, and there is, in bold letters, is the word cunt, and then there is a drawing of a woman's vagina, hairy vagina. And I thought this was groundbreaking for the time that it was painted, but this was an homage to a work by Pauline Boaty that was Bum, which was the same sort of setup. So yours was kind of an appreciation of that. And going back, and she was in her 20s, and she died when she was 28, tragically, 3 months after having her baby, because they said to her that you could either have an abortion or you could have the chemotherapy or the therapy at the time. And she said, I want the baby. And she had the baby and then died. Quite a tragic life when she was 28. But she was making this work in her early 20s when you became friends, right?
And it would be too much for me to say I was friends. I met her a couple of times.
Right.
You know, I was a student and she had left Royal College of Art. Mm-hmm. But she had the struggle to be an artist too.
Right.
Mm. She was advised that because women couldn't paint, that's the trope.
Yeah.
Women are second rate. Women can't paint. There are no great women artists. That was fed into us. Mm. Anyway, so she was told that she couldn't join the fine art department at Central. She went to Wimbledon first and then went to the Royal College of Art. They were channeling women into the crafts, so she did stained glass. Mm. And actually to tell you how far we've come, there were no ladies' loos in the Royal College of Art.
Really?
What the F?
But why are you surprised, boys?
I know.
So what would you have to do? You'd go into the men's then, or what? You just, where would you go?
What do you mean, where would you go? There weren't women there.
They had no women, babe.
You know, women, we did not exist. Mm. Don't, you know, listen.
That just blows mind.
You know, it's shocking for us because we grew up in the 80s,
yes.
where women were, you know, like, our mothers were quite strong.
We love our
women.
Moms. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So
we
I think it started to change.
We were fighting back in the 70s, but, you know, everything, patriarchy conspires to make women invisible. Mm. And you know, so long as you're, you know, you can look after the home, but in the public sphere, you know, you're not allowed. So, and you know, as a young woman, and I think many young women, you know, we're just overcoming this. You know, a big N-O, let alone bum or cunt, but it was a big two-letter word, no, which was right up in front of us, and we just had to kick it down.
Mm. And you have, I mean, what you've been doing for years, you've been trailblazing your work, and you said you've been making it kind of quietly, but these pieces now are starting to be seen by so many people, and they're changing the dialogue of art history, and you've been here the whole time making these works. How many works have you got, do you think? And do you store them in your house, or where have these all been kept safely?
Well, I've got to say, I am standing on the shoulder of women artist giants. Yeah. You know, I'm here because of the fantastic example of men and women. Because, like, I like to reach out and say, it's not as if it's only women who've had to struggle. Male artists have had to struggle too, and many male artists have had to be in the closet and hidden the fact that they're gay.
Yeah.
To me, one of the most glorious exhibitions of the last couple of years was the queer exhibition at the Tate. And as a matter of fact, not only was, it was an exhibition that had more women artists in it than any group exhibition that I've ever seen in London.
Wow.
We're all gay. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was quite interesting. But I could give you some.
Yeah, definitely. There were some.
Women painters that I'm not very good at bringing them off at the top of my head, but artists or women of literature like Duna Barnes, Colette the writer, Gertrude Stein, George Sand, you know, these all women who've struggled, Natalie Barnett, you know, these are unusual women.
And didn't you get a thank from Jermaine Greer at in the Female Eunuch? She thanked you specifically in her.
Jermaine Greer is always a double-edged sword.
Okay.
Because I never told anybody that I was one of the dedicates for the Female Eunuch, because Jermaine's dedication, I mean, Jermaine can be absolutely vicious towards women. And so the dedication says something nice, and then the dedication begins, I think, Caroline, who danced but badly, who painted but badly. And so this is in 1971, and Jermaine is a huge lioness on the British social scene. Uh-huh. You know, her best friends are all the movers and shakers. And so Jermaine was going around her dinner party saying that I was a bad painter.
Wow.
However, I kept my sanity because Jermaine also said I danced but badly. And Jermaine, you do not get to dance on stage at Covent Garden if you're a bad dancer.
Yeah.
Mm. So Jermaine hadn't seen me dance. Mm-hmm. But it was that, you know, so...
give with one.
That was one of those kind of obstacles that, one had to... You have to keep focused, I think.
Yeah.
You have to...
How have you kept your focus?
Firstly, because we live in the West, where we are free, and I'm not going to complain so long as I have a roof over my head, and I am going to withhold the values that we've all fought for centuries in the West to be free. I'm going to be free to paint. And actually, I don't care an F-U-C-K what anybody thinks. By various means, often nefarious means, I'm going to do what I feel I was born to do. Mm. Because my parents were wealthy, I couldn't get a grant, so I did nude modelling to pay my way through art school. You know, you find ways, but if you really want to do something, read about other people who've had to struggle. And just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I think I heard a message that you gave as well about hope, and this idea that we all just have to hold on to hope to keep us all going, and just to remember that even if you're going through a really tough time in your life, like, you are able to somehow conquer it if you just hold on somehow.
And you got to give people hope. That's what Harvey Milk said. Mm. That was in his speech. You got to give them hope, because it is inspiring if people hope, can see hope, and you are a hopeful person. Totally. It feels like you've been hopeful forever.
But I think you have to, hope is an aspiration and a philosophy, but I think you have to work for it. Mm-hmm. And I think what I've learned in the decades of struggle not exactly on the barricades, but sometimes when you demonstrate, you are on the barricades. Mm. I was in Grosvenor Square in the demonstrations against the Vietnam War, literally being charged by mounted police, and then I was told that I couldn't get a visa to go to America because I'd committed moral turpitude by burning the American flag on the steps of the American embassy with Tariq Ali. But I mean, each generation can be a bit complacent. You think we've advanced, we've got these legal, we've changed the law, and you can sit back. But authoritarianism, I think, is the default position of humans. Censorship is the default authoritarian position. And you just have to, each generation has to go out and fight for the progress that you want to make your life whole and to make your life the good life that you want to lead with being tolerance, with being just, being fair, being alive, allowing other people to live. And if I can do that through my painting, then good. But other people do it through music. Mm. People do it through politics. Mm. You do it through broadcasting.
Yes, cool cup.
And you're acting as well.
Culture has the biggest effect on society. Culture is our messages move quickly through society.
And it reflects society. Which your work definitely does. And talking of censorship as well, the Tate in Liverpool actually censored one of your, removed one of your works or refused it to be on display, I think in 1995, which I find so fascinating because you'd done a painting depicting a semi-erect penis.
And a Manet's, Miss Olympia, isn't it? Mrs. Olympia. What was the Manet original?
It's called Olympia.
Yeah.
But do you know how that came about? I mean, what was the date? 1992 or something?
I think it was 95, maybe.
Something like that. Anyway, yeah. It was the Tate, that's a modern era, you would think. And the Tate had put on an exhibition of naked women, of sculptures of naked women. Uh-huh. And it was Matisse, Lipchitz, a variety of the greats of art doing sculpture of naked women. And so they suddenly, I think they must have thought, hold on a second, we need to balance this out by having an education pack and perhaps we should include some naked men. Mm. So I'm very lucky they came to me for a naked and they saw my, but they were, back in the day, I think that you look at slides. And so I had a tiny little slide which we sent them. And they said, yes, fantastic, you'll be in the, we've got all the permissions and everything. But then they blew the slide up. And in slightly enlarged, you could see that the Mr. Olympia, which was my reverse of Manet's Olympia, had what they call an ithy phallus, actually. I think that's the polite way for saying an erect penis. And then, so they had to, they thought, they said, no, and we can't have an erect penis. In this pact, however, it was perfectly acceptable to have every variety of female nakedness.
Of course. So where is Mr. Olympia now? So if it didn't get shown at Tate Liverpool, did it go somewhere else?
Mr. Olympia is amongst all my paintings, which are stored at home.
So you store your work at home?
Yes.
And how many paintings have you got there?
Well, I paint very slowly, very meticulously, and I paint quite big paintings, 4x5, a little bit larger sometimes, but they're kind of for a domestic space. And so I paint about 2 big paintings a year.
Wow.
I'm a slow painter.
And your studio is your house?
And I live above my shop. I have the sitting room, which is my studio.
And this is in Notting Hill?
This is in Ladbroke Grove.
West London. Yeah.
Where I've lived since I was 16. But I don't. That's another thing which is interesting because I'm so outside the art market.
Yeah,
and I don't want to lose that sense that my painting is going to remain meticulous. But I'm 75 now. Do I have 10 more years with eyesight and ability to paint? So what's twice 10? I might have 20 more paintings to do in my life.
Hopefully you're going to have a lot longer than that. Yes. I could see you going on into your hundreds.
Well,
I would love that.
It's possible. How old was Louise Bourgeois?
She's in her 90s, wasn't she?
And I mean, Carmen Herrera is 105
now. Still making work.
And Carol Rahm. Exactly. So I'm lucky. I'm touching wood at the moment.
And Yaya Kasama is, becoming elderly. Fantastic. And she's still making incredible
She is just don't put me in the same breath as her. Mm. She's just remarkable. But anyway, so I paint very slowly. So so my house is kind of stuck.
What's your inspiration for the artist? What artists are you looking at when you create your work?
Well, Yo-Yo Kusama for a start.
Right.
It's not necessarily, it's not the style of the work, but it's their passion.
Mm.
And there's always incredible work to see.
Mm.
Actually, I try to limit myself to seeing maybe 3 or 4 shows a year. Otherwise, you just get
overwhelmed.
Yes, exactly. But
or too influenced by it, maybe.
But it's life.
Mm.
It is the inspiration. I mean, we are so uniquely lucky on our planet, and the way people live and our struggles are. Splendors and misery, that's inspirational. The sadnesses we have, the poetics of our lives, the struggle that we have, it's all inspirational.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And if we were going to talk about the way your paintings actually look, if people haven't seen them yet, you make figurative paintings. And I've actually, it's quite interesting because your show that's on in London, loads of my friends through Instagram have been posting about it and seeing it, which is so brilliant because it's a whole new generation of people in their 20s, or even younger, and then in their 30s, discovering your work for the first time. And there's a theme that I've noticed. A lot of people keep mentioning I think he's Scottish painter called Howson, Peter Howson. And also, I started thinking a lot about 1920s and kind of people like Tamara Lempicka and
Christian Schad,
yeah. Exactly. But also, I grew up in a place called Cookham, and Stanley Spencer was the local painter there. And I also somehow see a kind of way that you might have responded to Spencer and taken it to a feminist and progressive kind of territory or something.
One of my Stanley Spencer, just one of my favourite artists. Political, very political.
Mm.
But figuration too, we forget how unpopular and how denigrated it was in the echelon, highest echelons of the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that, it was, for instance, I was feeling very, very low, I was going to an exhibition at the Serpentine. And it was all, I was going to say it's all constructivist, bits and pieces on the floor and that kind of, which I understand that I can, I could make a good case for that kind of art, but it wasn't anything that touched my soul. And I walked around the corner and saw this incredible painting by Peter Doig.
Mm-hmm.
And you forget that how to begin with, Peter Doig had to struggle
mm-hmm.
to be accepted as figuration.
Figuration goes in and out of painting. Favor.
Yeah. Yes, as painting.
Yeah.
And to me, despite technology, I like the idea of craft. I like canvas. I like the surface of the surface and smell of oil paint on canvas and size and wood and the wood stretches.
Terps, do you like the smell of terps?
I love the smell. The whole glorious organic mixture of the materials that one uses. I don't always do figurative work. If I'm feeling very low, I literally can't stand up in front of my canvas. And when I'm sitting on the floor, I'll do more abstract work.
Wow.
And when I was a child, I remember seeing Matisse's Snail.
Yes.
The Tate Gallery. And it was such a contrast to the figurative work of Matisse. Mm. And then I learned that Matisse had done the snail from his
bed
when he was ill as an old man.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought, okay, I'm going to do detailed, meticulous, figurative work until I'm very ill as an old person, and then I may be doing, maybe do more abstract work.
Mm-hmm.
And a bit of an abstract work is an abstract colour field is coming into my painting a bit more.
Wonderful.
But, you know, from the political aspect of my work, I need figuration, because once you have figurative art, you have to, there's politics there.
Mm.
Actually, abstract is not without politics, but it's the abstract art is non-political, which is also political. But I have to, for narrative paintings, I have to have, it has to be figurative.
What's amazing about your work now that it's coming to the forefront is because we are becoming so much more aware of the use of pronouns and non-binary and fluidity and sexuality, and the characters in your paintings, which would have been, still are controversial, are like hermaphrodites. They have breasts, they have penises, they have vaginas. They're not really, you can't say what gender they are. And you are making this work, you've been making this work for so long, and it just feels so now. That's what's so exciting, is that it feels like the zeitgeist. You have captured the zeitgeist, but you have had that zeitgeist at the forefront of your work for so long. And now it feels like it's completely speaking to the dialogue of what it is to be, you know, sexuality now.
I just think that it's taken quite a long while for that discourse, or the outsiders, or the gay or queer to become mainstream.
Mm.
And that is a huge relief, really, for all of us who want to be what
fluid.
We are.
Yeah.
Yes, fluid.
Is that how you describe your own sexuality?
It's interesting because as a teenager, reading a lot, I liked Jung rather than Freud.
Right.
And I remember in my sketchbooks, I was looking at them, going back on them to look at where I was in the sketchbooks when I was 17, 18. And there's I've written down from Jung, who says, human beings must come to terms with the male and female in their nature. So that's me as a teenager.
Mm.
Looking at the patriarchal binary and saying, that's not me.
Mm.
You know, I'm just as good a shot shooting a gun or a bow and arrow as my brother. You know, what has taught our parents to think in these binaries.
Mm.
I heard you talk about, I called Russell earlier and I said, I'm so excited to meet Caroline, because there's this idea that, like, you know, holding on to hope, and then also this idea of feminism and how young women now have a language that they can use as a powerful tool to fight patriarchy and oppression, and that language has been something that's grown in your lifetime. So from you being a young girl, when you felt all these things, you didn't necessarily have the right words, you weren't armed at that time with the right language, or the, you know, there weren't books, and they, you know, whereas now you have that. And I was so empowered and so excited, because I feel like your life, I mean, people who don't necessarily know you now, you've had this incredible, fascinating life in the music industry. You wrote for Melody Maker, you managed The Clash,
arrested.
You were part of the punk scene, you know, but you were also from a time of, like, before the punk scene, of hippies, and this idea of, like, free love and Woodstock and all of those eras. I had never thought about the whole Woodstock time as being a patriarchal device almost,
yeah,
or a kind of the way it was used to free male liberation. So it was almost like the 60s, which is meant to be this idea of free love. And you always see, like, nude women and nude men with their long hair, and everyone, you know, and Joni Mitchell is actually someone that always comes to my mind, who is such a strong female voice, who I still to this day respect and admire and love. But you've described it as being this kind of male liberation, and it was a way for men to feel okay about having sex and actually still oppressing women through doing that. So it was a kind of, like, new kind of patriarchy. It's fascinating.
I think all these things are very complex. And the complexity of the 60s, a lot of that has been erased.
Mm.
And to me, the 60s was was a period of male liberation,
yeah,
and a period of working class male liberation, white male liberation.
Yeah.
And it was liberating for women because we had the pill for the first time. And so we were freed from the obligation of being treated like condoms,
right?
In the sense that men, especially if you were working class, men could use women for their sexual delight and just discard us, throw us aside, throw our babies aside. Yeah. But we were also trying to combat religious, what's the word for it when you are... when you hate sex. It's not Puritanism, religion is anti-sex.
Mm. Right.
To break free of the religious, to say that sex was evil, mm. You could only have sex within marriage, and the naked body was evil. Mm. The whole idea of us women throwing off our clothes and the Woodstock generation and men growing their hair long, that was gender blur. Mm. It was breaking down these patriarchal divisions. Mm. And it was so dangerous that was very quickly put back in its box. Do you remember when Mick Jagger and David Bowie were talking about being gay or...
Yeah. Or bi or whatever.
And then suddenly renounced it. More fluid.
It was like the original fluidity. Exactly.
And how quickly, to have come out like that, mm. It was literally meant that you could be killed on the streets. Wow. You can still be killed on the streets if you're gay. But it's just an indication to me of how hard it is to break mm. down these patriarchal tropes.
Right.
And that you have to, each generation has to stand on the barricades. But what women discovered and why feminism of the 70s, the second generation feminism was born, was because the very famous line that Stokely Carmichael said in, I think it was 1970, when was asked by a woman, we were trying to work shoulder to shoulder with men to be progressive in society. And the question was asked, what is woman's role in the revolution? Because those early pioneers were just making the tea, and it was getting very onerous. Mm-hmm. And Stokely Carmichael said, echoing a kind of a patriarchal trope from all the men around us, mm. Was, "Oh, the woman's role is horizontal." Mm. And so a lot of the men who were wanting to be liberated also wanted the entitlements of the patriarchy, and so. Us women who wanted to be out as sexually liberated women mm. Were called whores, pussies, mm. slags, sluts, 100 different ways mm-hmm. of
derogatory,
of frightening women into
sexuality,
away from being sexual, back into the house.
Whereas men yes. were just, I remember hearing studs. You say they were just called studs, yeah. and there's yeah. only one word. It's kind of like pretty yeah. much that's
Isn't
what it was.
It is fascinating how many words there are, and you've actually made a video piece,
which I love,
beautiful, where you're sat in white and you're dipping your hands into a bucket of like red fluid, like blood, and you're putting it over yourself, and you're reciting. There's a voiceover of all the different terminologies that women can be degraded with. Hence,
but not only women. These are the words that I say, like slut, skit, whore. In my piece, I Am Whore,
yeah.
is what 5-year-old girls are hearing in the playground today.
Mm.
You know, there's the young women are still having to fight this battle, mm. And I'm here because of a lot of things that. Of course, the men who have encouraged me. And I reach out to all the men who are shoulder to shoulder with us today, fighting these patriarchal binaries, mm. Who are interested in the idea of consent, who are interested in, instead of rape, learning how to be sexually seductive. We don't have to indulge in sadomasochism, as a matter of fact. There is an alternative. You might read the Kama Sutra. There are different ways to be human, which doesn't include force and mm. violence. Mm.
Do you feel a huge affinity with the LGBT community and your work and throughout your life and career?
Yes. I've... I've always, given that I was at a boarding school, a co-educational boarding school since the age of five. You know where your sexuality is from that very, very early age, and so you know, I've always known that I'm bisexual. But that's another thing that's quite difficult, because you don't want to be labelled. There are many feminisms that we keep adding initials to the LGBTQ plus, because there's so many varieties of what we want to be. And so I'm for adult consent, adult pleasure, variety.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
so your work now, is that what happens next for Caroline Coon? So you've got this show on at Tramps, which is a huge success and really highlighting your practice and what you've been doing, and you're getting a lot of attention from that. Do you feel this attention on you now, and where do you go from here?
Luckily, I'm an old lady now, and I've seen and I've shepherded a lot of young people through early success. So I'm trying to learn the lessons.
Like who?
I'm practicing.
Shepherded the Clash through their early.
Didn't
you even take one of the pictures on their album, record sleeves? White Riot, wasn't it?
Yes, because I was interested in what counterculture was doing after the hippie movement. I was looking out for what was coming next.
What is counterculture? Can we just highlight that for the listeners?
Counterculture was the opposition to the establishment, I guess, the opposition to the mainstream, and what's going on all the time underneath that, what I call the mainstream crust.
Yeah.
And, you know, it bursts out, and it's there to change culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it does change culture. You know, art really does change things. And so long as we are free to make art, then I think society is free. But I'm holding on to the fact that my painting hasn't changed.
Mm.
What's changed is that Martin Green and James Lawler and Peter Doig and Parinath Mogadasi have framed my work differently. And that's enabled people to look at my work in a different way.
And I love this story that you wrote to Peter Doig right at the beginning of his career, maybe even after you saw that painting at the Serpentine. And there's this narrative of you having written him a letter, and it meant so much to him at that time, because there was a lot of opposition to painting, and painting was dead, or it often happens, doesn't it? Every 20 years, people are like, painting's over, which is so insane. But he remembered that really touching him and almost spurring him forward and feeling like someone believed in his work. Even if you weren't like a close friend of his at that time. And then when he heard about your Liverpool show, which was really well received and quite a remarkable exhibition, he then thought, how can I help now? I've got to help her. And I really respect that, because I think it's a brilliant thing that you did for him to like reach out. And I really encourage people to reach out and support people that they like, and don't just assume that they know they're great. Because often, even if they're well known, they don't often get told, we love this or
he's an amazing champion though, Peter Doig. He's done that for a lot. There's another artist called Denzel Forrester. Do you know Denzel's work?
I know his work.
He's an amazing artist. And he, again, has been kind of in the margins of the art world. And Peter has really brought him into the forefront. And now he's having these incredible positions. He's been positioned in an incredible place. And he's got this big mural at Brixton Station at the minute, which is a massive honour. And Peter, again, has done that. He seems like a massive champion for talent, for like,
and I just love that you were a champion of Peter's.
Yeah.
So it's like, and that you've been a champion of many artists.
Well, I think because it's where you get your inspiration, I think, and to me, to be in the margin is quite a strong place to be. But I think that anybody who has got in a position to recommend, like when I was writing for Melody Maker. I was in a position to recommend people to go to a Sex Pistols gig. But that's what you do if you're an artist, or if you're culturally aware. And it's what you're doing. Which is what's necessary about a talk art podcast.
Mm.
You know, you're reaching out to people, and that's the most hopeful thing I think you can do.
Mm. We're giving people hope, Rob.
We are. Well, you're giving us hope as well, though. It's a really wonderful thing.
So you're selling your work now?
I'm not sure that I will sell my work.
But yet. Has work not sold from this show, or do you know?
I hope it will sell eventually, but you know, that would be nice. But yes, we'll see.
It's almost never been the motivation behind it either.
No.
And you know what I find so fascinating? This is the other thing I really want to quickly say, is that your life story, I mean, if you want to hear an amazing life story, there's a movie in your life story, because you've been through so many different social changes in society, like huge shifts every decade, and different political challenges even to this day, every decade. You know, it's a fascinating thing. And you've been involved in, like, from that early kind of 60s and then the punk and then the 90s and then present day, and how attitudes are shifting all the time.
I was just imagining Felicity Jones playing you in your life story.
Really? Yeah.
I want to be able to shut the studio door and paint the paintings that I've got a list that are on my list to paint. You know,
so good.
I will go out of the studio when necessary, and for instance, I will go out if it's to do, if it's to make a political connection.
Yeah.
To advance an issue a notch forward, if possible.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's that. You know, that's all one can do. But I, you know, I paint because it's an essential thing, an essential part of my humanity. But it's not been about money, because, you know, I would have stopped painting a long time ago if it would have been about money.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, to me, it's lack of money that I refuse to allow to stop me painting, which is why I did nude modelling and then worked as a sex worker.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nothing's going to stop me painting. Lack of money is not going to stop me painting.
Was you painting during all this time as well?
Yeah, it's... Or, you know, right from the start, you know, when I was managing The Clash, I was painting. You know, my studio has been that solid, quiet, still place where I go to.
Every day?
6 to 6 every day.
Wow.
It's like a constant kind of discipline.
Pulse, it's your pulse.
Felt. Yeah, it's amazing. And what I was trying to say, I've just remembered, is that all of that experience and your incredible life story... actually is relevant, because even though you can sensationalize elements of your life, and, you know, I imagine certain journalists would love to, like, have headlines that talk about the brothel series of paintings, or, you know, even your punk era, because it's kind of stuff
can I stop you there?
Yeah.
It's not sensationalizing.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that commercial sex or sex work is absolutely central to what society is.
Yeah.
And the fact that you may be watching pornography, or people out there watching, that is work that has been produced by men and women who are doing work.
Yeah.
But because what is the reason that you think that consenting adults should be sent to prison for doing sex work? That is the rock bed of patriarchy.
Yeah.
And until we say that consenting adults can do with their bodies whatever they like, whether it's to sell, it's to do sex work for money, then all these other things that patriarchy stands on will continue apace. And so it's, I would like my brothel series to be sensationalized.
Yeah.
Because I will say, you know, you are, all of you, if you are using pornography, are using the brothel.
And the
way that you can make yourself whole is to stop calling that sensation.
It's
that
is right.
That, you know, yeah, that is the real world. It's not sensational. You know, get used to it.
You actually
what
have a painting
doing
called Prostitute Stoning the Hypocrites.
Yes.
Which I think is one of the most powerful pieces.
It's incredible. So, yeah.
Let's be honest about our sexual needs. I mean, if you want to to sensationalize it, right since when I first started Release and had a kind of a public profile, my nude modeling was, you know, on the same page as that discussion, you know, discussions about legal aid.
Right.
You know, I was naked on the law page of Time magazine.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that to me, that's a huge hypocrisy. And we, you know, we've got to understand our sexuality if we're going to be, human beings who live in a good way and treat each other well. So, you know.
And actually, the point I wanted to make was that you've had this great life story, but that's all in the work. And I think your work is, like you're saying, talking about, if you talk about legalizing prostitution or brothels or that kind of thing, like, it's in the work. And your work is bringing around social change because it's there and it will outlive all of us. And that's actually what I think I'm grateful for as you as an artist, because I think your work will outlive me, it will outlive Russell, it will outlive you, and it will still help change. And that's what's powerful. And in a way, it's not, I know it's useful to have headlines because that also brings change. But to me, it's beyond, you know, just simply sensationalizing something, because it's powerful. Like,
but let me, what do you, as you two youths, think about?
Oh, I like you calling us youths.
I don't feel like a youth anymore.
You look youthful. You are a beautiful youth.
Thank you.
Beautiful youth. So it's lovely to be spoken to or with. Anyway.
Are you blushing?
Yes. What do you think of the materiality of the kind of paint that Peter Doig is using or that I'm using?
What do we think of the materiality? I think it gives you so much depth because you're living in a technical.
Everything is screens.
I think it's the most powerful medium for showing humanity. Like, I think the way that you or Peter or any, you know, great painter.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier because you've actually done a self-portrait in the show where you are painting yourself now, and every character in your paintings is very sinewy. You can see like the muscle tone. They almost feel kind of anatomical, like Leonardo da Vinci, sort of like.
Yeah, like skill as well.
The genesis of man. But you painted, there's this self-portrait of you, and you've painted yourself looking a lot older than you actually do look in real life, but like as a celebration.
And I love that in the work as well, that the idea of the celebration of an older body as well.
But I'm talking about as young men.
Yeah.
You know, who are used to technology and who are used to
We were born for the internet. It's like, but I'm obsessed with Instagram and the internet. Yes.
But do you what do you think the value of an artist like me painting on canvas?
I think it's more directly to the soul somehow, and I feel like that's what's special about
it. Survives.
Painting.
It's as Rob was saying, it's going to outlive all of us. Paintings are essential to show a dialogue of what it is to be alive,
and it slows us down. And I think it makes us think about things in a much slower way, which, you know, you can sit in front of a painting for hours,
yes,
and it can change every day.
If you do that on the internet,
keep making
you
think about things. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think painting is, you know,
what do you think,
really
then?
Important.
Why'd you ask that question?
Because trying to be hopeful about craft and organic things and the material of the earth, the spirituality of nature,
harnessing and energy,
and where, you know, what's where that's going to go, and can we keep that alive? You know,
I'm 100% sure we will keep it alive.
We're just trying. We are championing.
We recently interviewed a gallerist called Tommaso Corvimora who makes ceramics. And if you look at the development of ceramics, we did a whole hour long interview with him about
evolution.
And we love ceramics, but that is also a phenomenon since, say, 2013, something, it started to come into the art world, this idea of ceramics and craft and how there is no distinction between the two
hierarchy.
Because they're both great. And I do think people, we as human beings need to create things with our hands. And I think painting's so important. But that's also why we love what you're doing, because...
Yeah, you're a storyteller, Caroline, and we all want to hear your story.
You're a truth teller, actually, and you bring truth to power
truth
as well,
say,
many
yeah.
times.
That's what I feel passionate about, and that's why I'm interested, because it's the handmade... Which I, you know, the touching of your gesture, your hand gesture onto material, whether it's wood or paint or wood paper, to me that has a great value, and I would hate for that in 20 years' time when I'm gone, for that element of human creativity to be lost.
You know what's fascinating? A lot of universities and schools shut down their ceramics department. This is just a kind of example. And then the response to that was artists started setting up their own ceramics department, and they would go and buy very cheap kilns or very cheap, you know, materials that had been thrown that had all been thrown onto the street. I've heard so many stories in Frankfurt, in London, and there's people like Aaron Angel who set up a kind of artist-run Troy Town, which was the idea of people making ceramics, you know, and he did something like 68 different artists in the space of a year or something. It was insane. So there is, you know, it will survive. You can try try and shut it down, but it always comes back. And that is something in the human soul. We want to you know, to express ourselves.
We ask everyone that comes on, though, two questions. The first one we want to ask is, if you could do an art heist, you could steal any work of art in the world, your touchstone artwork, and live with it, what would it be and why?
I wouldn't steal it, but I would make sure that it was preserved forever. It would be probably something at the National Gallery, like the Van Dyck Arnolfini Marriage.
Oh, yes.
Love that little exquisite painting.
Beautiful.
Or even to take it back.
Well, that was the first selfie, everyone says, because he's painted into the back in the mirror.
I just absolutely love the whole
mystery.
What would you do?
Take it back where?
Well, to preserve it, to make sure that it would, you know, maybe, yes, I wouldn't like to steal it.
Yeah.
Make sure the National Gallery could preserve it forever. But another painting which I absolutely adore, which is, and I'm, I hope that you're going to edit this because I'm going to waffle now to see if we can find the name of it.
Yeah.
But it's in the early English section, and it's a diptych with angels, and it's absolutely exquisite piece.
It's not the Wilton diptych.
Yeah, the Wilton diptych.
The Wilton diptych. So
it would be
in the 1300s.
Yes.
And it's a small portable diptych of two hinge panels.
And when you open it, it's this beautiful pale blue angels, and it's just the really most delicate kind of
stunning. It's so stunning.
We'll
post an image on our Instagram.
It's absolutely exquisite, and although I'm not religious, I like the way people express their awe of life.
Yes.
And that painting, to me, it's a religious icon to be traveled around with the king to pray in front of. I just like the spirit of awe and love and passion that artist put into that painting. So for me it would be the Wilton diptych and
the
Arnolfini marriage.
And the other question we ask every guest is, what's your favorite color?
My favorite color at the moment, it's red. I'm doing a red painting at the moment, and my next painting is going to be lots of red.
Wow.
Yes.
Red is such a life force.
Blood.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you get a lot of inspiration from looking out of your window? Do you use that as a view for the studio? Do you have a window?
I have a window, and it's a tough window to look out of at the moment. And it makes me, every day I look out of my studio, into me determined to be socially conscious, because I look out onto the Grenfell Tower.
Wow.
And at 3 o'clock in the morning, a couple of years ago, I was woken up by a helicopter overhead. Looked out of the window, and I saw people burning to death.
Oh my God.
And to me, the Grenfell Tower is an icon, or a monument to the capitalistic fraud.
A monolith, I think.
And, all of us in the neighbourhood of Ladbroke Grove who look out onto the Grenfell Tower, I'm very happy that I'm a politically conscious artist. Because if you look at, when you look out on the world and you see the horrors like that, then.
And it is right on your doorstep. Yeah. I mean, it's just shocking.
Yes. Well, I think each community has something as shocking as that.
Yes, exactly, yeah. But also, you've painted your local kind of
world.
Neighborhood, haven't you, in your work as well, a lot, which,
At Tramps at the moment, there's a painting of flowers, and there's a slither down the side of it where there's a tower block. And funnily enough, it was the tower block, the twin tower to the Grenfell Tower.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, I've done sketches of, I go out sketching a lot, I've done sketches of the Grenfell Tower, but it's how to incorporate something as tragic as that into one's art. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to do that yet. Given that I do my urban landscapes, it's bound to be there sometimes.
It must
sometimes.
Factor into your decision, mate.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's going to be there. It's going to be there somehow. Artists, be socially conscious.
Yes.
Paint progress.
Yeah.
Paint protest. Paint.
Definitely. Wonderful. Well, on that inspiring message.
We love you. My God,
interview.
Thank you
we love
so,
you so much.
Much.
And thank
Are you still
you.
Nervous, or have you chilled?
More
now?
Nervous now.
Oh, no.
No, I mean, I feel a responsibility. You've given me a kind of, you know, you've put some responsibility on my shoulders.
Oh, well, really?
Yes. Is that, that's good, really, though, isn't it?
I guess so, but I also think
make you feel responsible.
All you have
anything,
to do is just be yourself, really.
We just want to
pick you up,
big
you up. Job
say, yeah, we want to encourage you to keep, please keep going, because we love
you.
I think you're brilliant.
And keep going, you too.
Thank you very much.
And for everyone who wants to see images of Caroline's work, we'll be posting images on at Talk Art, which is our Instagram. And the exhibition at Tramps runs until, I think, the 22nd of December in London. Please go and see it, because paintings and art is made to be seen in person. Mm-hmm. So don't just look at it on Instagram. Please actually make a journey and see the exhibition. And we will be back very soon.
Thank you very
Caroline.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a joy.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.